You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Good afternoon. I'm Darrell West, Vice President of Governance Studies and Director of the Center for Technology Innovation at the Brookings Institution, and I'm pleased to welcome you to this forum on improving spectrum access through reverse auctions. In its national broadband plan, the FCC called for the identification of 500 megahertz of new wireless spectrum over the next decade. The commission also proposed that spectrum should be reallocated from over-the-air broadcast television to mobile service providers. The FCC did this because wireless broadband is growing at a rapid pace. There's been a tremendous growth in smartphones and people using mobile devices for communications, healthcare, education, energy savings, and a wide variety of other uses. Congress passed legislation that was signed into law in February, giving the FCC authority to hold reverse auctions for broadcasters with unused spectrum. But there are many design and implementation issues yet to be resolved. Today, we are hosting a conversation about how auctions should operate. So among other topics, we'll analyze how the auction should be conducted, what are the best design features to maximize broader societal benefits, and how do various rules and procedures affect the likely outcome. To help us understand these issues, we're pleased to welcome a number of distinguished speakers. Thomas Power will provide opening remarks. He is currently the Deputy Chief Technology Officer for Telecommunications in the Office of Science and Technology Policy in the Executive Office of the President. He advises the President on a wide range of technology and telecommunications issues. Previously, he served as Chief of Staff for the National Telecommunications and Information Administration. After he speaks, we will have a panel discussion with several experts. Thomas Hazlett is Professor of Law and Economics and Director of the Information Economy Project at the George Mason University School of Law. He also serves as a columnist for the New Technology Policy Forum hosted by the Financial Times. He is an expert on spectrum and the author of a new paper entitled Incentive Auctions, Economic and Strategic Issues. And we actually have copies out in the hallway, so anyone who did not pick one up can get one after this event. Peter Pitch is Executive Director for Communications and Associate General Counsel for the Intel Corporation. In that position, he manages Intel's global spectrum and telecommunications policy team. Prior to joining Intel, he was the president of Pitch Communications and represented telecommunications clients before the FCC and Congress. And from 1981 to 1989, Peter also served at the FCC as chief of the Office of Plans and Policy and then chief of staff to the chairman of the FCC. Chris Gutman-McCabe is vice president of regulatory affairs at CTIA. He joined that organization in 2001 and works on spectrum, regulatory issues, and homeland security. Our last speaker will be Mark Fratrick, who's Vice President and Chief Economist at BIA Kelsey. He manages the firm's numerous proprietary databases and conducts primary research on various trends as they affect radio and television broadcasting. So first, we will hear from Thomas Power. So please join me in welcoming Mr. Power to Brookings.
Thanks. Thanks a lot, and good afternoon. I'm going to try to jump right into this. I normally, when I start talking about spectrum, I start evangelizing about the impact on the economy and jobs and productivity. I think I'm preaching to the choir on that one. So I'm going to kind of talk about two things. One, a couple years ago, the president issued a presidential memorandum directing NTIA to work with the FCC to identify 500 megahertz of spectrum that could be repurposed from either federal or commercial uses to wireless broadband. So I want to kind of give an update on that. There's so much going on in this area, I thought, just to sort of reset where we are on that. And then secondly, the concept of spectrum sharing is gaining a lot of currency recently, and I kind of just want to make a few remarks about how we look at spectrum sharing. So starting with the 500 megahertz search, the President's memorandum came out in June of 2010. About 4 or 5 months later, NTIA served up the first batch of spectrum, if you will. The idea was to sort of move through the bands sequentially, find bands that were both susceptible to repurposing and attractive to the commercial industry. So the first swath was two bands actually totaling 115 megahertz, the 1695 to 1710 band and the 3550 to 3650 band. And those were then sort of handed off to the FCC to figure out specifically how to make them best available on the commercial side. All these bands, there are always challenges with them. And I'll describe them because it actually will help inform when I talk about sharing in a couple minutes. So just as an example, in the 3550 band, one of the obstacles there is that the existing federal uses include these big naval ship-borne radars that use Spectrum for their radar systems. And when NTIA put out the report, they include some maps that showed what would be the presumptive exclusion zones. So those would be areas where the federal systems would operate and commercial systems would not be permitted to operate, just presumptively. And the exclusion zones is sort of drawn on that map, sort of assume that you have ships ringing the coasts all the time, blasting their radars 24/7. That doesn't happen. In fact, when the ships are in port, they don't use their radars. And so it was sort of a first take at what kinds of protections we'd have to think about. But once you start figuring out where the ships are really located and when they actually use their radar, that map could look a lot different. And so, again, as it relates to sharing that I'll talk a little bit about more, you know, it's not necessarily the case that we have to have exclusion zones. The problem with those exclusion zones is that given the characteristics of the radar, they could be 50 or 100 miles in from the coast. And so if you think of drawing that line, you know, down the East Coast, across the Gulf of Mexico, and up the West Coast, you've hit all the big major metropolitan areas. Not real appealing for the commercial guys, not a lot of value there because of the limited population that would be left. But is there a way we could shrink those exclusion zones or otherwise work to make that more usable? And those are the kinds of things the FCC is looking at now in that band. So that was the first 115 megahertz. We then shifted the focus to the 1755 band. The NTIA issued a report looking at 95 megahertz from 1755 to 1850. The commercial industry was very interested and remains very interested in the lower 25 megahertz of that, and for good reason. It pairs up well with a separate band, 2155 to 2180, so you can have the uplink and the downlink. It's internationally harmonized, which is very important for basically scale purposes. It means you've got more equipment being built, driving down costs that fits into that band. But there was this issue of the lower 25 versus looking at the whole band. On the one hand, you'd think, well, if we could just focus on that lower 25 and move as quickly as possible on that, that would be great. That would solve the need. There was a way to do it. From the administration standpoint, you know, we were shooting for 500 total, and so we wanted to take a bigger look at it, at the whole band. And also there were systems that operated in the whole band and up and down the whole band. And so for some agencies, the idea of looking at just the lower 25, you sort of had to look at the whole 95 anyway. So we're doing that. I mean, but the risk is, you know, are you biting off more than you can chew? Does thinking big actually slow you down? So to attack that, what we've done is created five working groups of agency and industry teams that are being put together right now to really dig in and to look at this. And, again, to come up with solutions, kind of like what I was talking about with the ship radars. How do you make this really usable for the commercial side while still protecting the federal interests? We have five working groups because the array of federal systems in there varies quite a bit, and so the way to work around them is going to vary quite a bit. We have some fixed microwave systems that can be relocated in a fairly short period of time. But you have satellite systems where the satellites are destined to operate for 20 or 30 years, and those are going to stay there. Those are going to be there. You can't send a technician up, you know, to switch out some hardware. At least that's what they tell me. I actually thought, well, maybe you could, and I called Comcast because they do truck rolls, right? And they said they could send somebody, but there would have to be somebody up there between 2 and 4 p.m. So anyway, we're now really focused on that 1755 band, and back to this issue of getting into that lower 25. that seems workable. The fact that we're looking at the whole band doesn't mean you have to solve for the whole band and have everything coordinated simultaneously. So there's ways to transition systems in, ways to have auctions that are staged, and commercial entry that is staged, and commercial exit that is staged, and to solve for the whole band in that way. That hopefully, you know, our goal here is really to expedite entry, and we think that's the best way to go. And it's been great to see the involvement on the commercial side and the agency side coming together with these teams to make that happen. And then, although that's still going on, we have launched the analysis of the next band, which is up in the 5 gigahertz range. It's where there's a lot of unlicensed use today, and we'll be pursuing that over the next few months to figure out some solutions there to open that up as well. We're sort of doubling down on our homework there because we're still the complexity and the urgency of the task with the 1755. We're still working on that, but we wanted to get started on the next 5 gig range as well. So those are sort of the work streams that are in progress. And I should mention, and talking about the industry involvement here, on behalf of the industry and with CTI support, T-Mobile filed a request at the FCC a few weeks ago, speaking special temporary authority to operate their systems in the vicinity of federal systems to really start testing. And again, it kind of goes back to this idea of sharing. Is there tolerance that can be sustained, even if there is some interference? Is it as bad as we think, or how can we engineer around that? Verizon committed $5 million to sharing technologies and to testing these technologies. So that's all great. It's coming to very together well. I said I also wanted to talk a little bit more specifically about sharing. You know, we do it today in the form of exclusion zones. Those exist all over. So you've got some federal operation somewhere, essentially draw a ring around it. And when commercial entities are licensed, they're not licensed in those areas, but they are licensed elsewhere. Sharing has taken on a lot more meanings than that in the TV white spaces that the FCC is implementing. That's a form of sharing. You know, probably the longer term, there's a lot of development going on with agile radios, smart radios that can sense out where they are, where frequencies are, where the device is, figure out what's usable and hop between them. You know, obviously a little bit more longer term, but that is a form of sharing. New architectures with smaller cells is a form of sharing. It allows a lot more reuse. These can all be types of sharing, and I think sometimes when we talk about sharing, it seems like we are talking about creating obstacles or producing spectrum that's really not the same as the spectrum that the commercial carriers need and that consumers and businesses need. We want shared spectrum to be just like cleared spectrum to the carriers and to the users. There'll be some more work involved, but the whole point here is to encourage and build on the great productivity and innovation we have seen in the deployment of spectrum and all the investment that the commercial carriers are doing. We just want more of that. And so this is intended to make it really usable. If the technologies are not here today, then that's not something we're relying on today. But to the extent there are ways of sharing today and that makes for a more efficient way of getting spectrum in the hands of commercial carriers, that's what it's all about. Sharing does not mean unlicensed, certainly. You know, just like today, some auctions are, you know, you acquire spectrum at auction, and it's subject to these exclusion zones. That's sharing, but it's licensed, and it's auctioned. And I should also point out that, you know, the challenge we're facing here is, you know, skyrocketing demand on the commercial side. We've seen those numbers. The same thing happens on the federal side. You know, you can pick up the papers and see the use of unmanned aerial vehicles, the drones that are used. They're used overseas, but they're tested here, and the testing here requires lots of spectrum. And the demand just in that one area has multiplied many times in the last 10 years, and that takes spectrum as well. And there are lots of important missions that the federal government is using. And so this comes down to physics. The reason we're talking about sharing is because we have a finite resource in the form of spectrum and more demand coming from both sides. We have still identified opportunities for clearing, and when that makes sense, that's the right way to go. And as I said, in the 1755 band, there are systems that we can move out and move out rather quickly as part of the solution here. And we understand that from the commercial side, and actually from the agency side too, any of these sort of new approaches there's inherently some uncertainty around them. And so folks, you know, have a little trepidation about it, to say the least. And they can be a cost, right? If you're talking about small cell architecture and new architectures like that, you know, that requires investments. And if there is a cheaper way in the form of, say, clearing spectrum that makes more sense, then of course that's the way you would point to. But it is a finite resource, and we are going to need to look at new approaches, and I'm very optimistic. It's been great that that the industry has been supportive of this. There's a lot of collaboration going on, and I think we're going to get there within the president's 10-year time frame. We also, of course, with the help of a number of people in this room, put a lot of work into the recent spectrum legislation, which gave rise to the auctions that we're going to hear about shortly. I will just say on that, we were very pleased to see that legislation passed. There's going to be a lot of hard work, but Chairman Jenikowski and the team over there, you know, these are the folks that, just like we have shown leadership and the industry has shown leadership in the 4G world and deploying that, I think the FCC is seen as the leader in spectrum auctions. And so we're looking forward to that. They've got a great team over there with Gary Epstein and Ruth Milkman and the rest of the team. So we're very much looking forward to that. So I just wanted to lay that little predicate. I know these guys will be able to inform us a lot more specifically on the great work that's going to be coming up on the spectrum auction. So thank you, and thanks to Brookings for having me. Thanks.
I think I could get that much right.
Okay, so in our panel, we're going to focus on the reverse auctions, and Thomas has a new paper out on incentive auctions, and you have a copy of the paper, so I know you cannot summarize all the details because there are lots of design and implementation issues associated with that, but I was wondering if you could just start us off by identifying what you see as the major challenges and what some of the highlights are of what you think we need to do.
Thank you. This is a real audience? These aren't Pixar drones, are they?
They're not enough bandwidth.
No, this is a human audience. Well, that's very nice. How old-fashioned. Anyway, speaking of old-fashioned, my name is Tom, and I'm a PowerPoint user. But no PowerPoint today, so I'm going to be challenged. I had some great slides. I'll describe them to you, all the graphics. By the way, the title of my talk, Occupy Spectrum.
It worked.
You needed the graphics. So Yes. More spectrum, please. There is tremendous incremental social value to getting more liberally licensed spectrum in the marketplace. And there's some question about, well, can't the carriers do something to cope with the mobile data tsunami? And yes, the carriers are doing lots of things to cope with the tsunami. You want them to do all of that and more, and they can do more if they have more bandwidth. And the National Broadband Plan from 2010 makes a very good case on this. I recommend it highly. I think it's a positive step. But documenting the rigidities of the current system does not end them, and we're still confronted by them. And certainly we're looking to many places. We just heard about many of the initiatives underway at the Department of Commerce. The mother lode is the TV band, and so it's not surprising that that is where attention has focused. And the FCC has put forward a particular strategy to try to unleash some of the opportunities there with the incentive auctions. And I just want to put this in historical perspective. We were talking about this type of two-sided approach in November of 2001 at an AEI Brookings Joint Center for Regulatory Studies conference. Okay, so this is what's considered a brand new idea in Washington. There are other options, and I recommend, again, the National Broadband Plan's discussion of many of them, including overlays and some other things beyond that broadband plan, third-party audits that might really help get more spectrum, more bandwidth into the market. And I think those initiatives really should be remembered as the next step and the next step and the next step. We don't want to back everything up until we get through this incentive auction opportunity. And we do need to think a little bit about transaction costs, because it's very important in this process, and it's going to be important in all the processes. And part of the opportunity costs of the incentive auctions are this session. More specifically, what we could be doing if we weren't in this session. Okay? And don't let me get you started on that. Just stay with me for another 3 minutes. But there are lots of things we're doing here that are costly. Reducing the reallocation that may have started at 100 and, well, it started at 294 megahertz. That's the TV band. Then it went to 120. It may be shaved down further than that. Anytime we reduce that reallocation, we're essentially lowering the opportunity society has from getting the spectrum repurposed. Of course, nothing is perfect. There's no zero transaction cost solution. It's going to be procedurally expensive to get this done. That's part of that game. But we want to look at other opportunities that may be out there. And I want to just put that on the table. So, talking specifically about incentive auctions, it's complicated. The goal now should be expeditious and efficient, okay? And we have a paper that I wrote with David Porter and Vernon Smith, who've been around the block a lot on auctions and market design. And we try to, just in a nuts and bolts way, elucidate what the general flashpoints are as we go through the process. At a very high level, this is actually a five-stage process. At least we characterize it that way. First, there's a reverse auction, and that's the broadcast TV stations offering to move or share based upon what they think the value of that option would be to them. Then the second stage is a relocation, where the FCC looks at its maps, its computer contours, and so forth, and it figures out, based in part on pricing, information from that reverse auction, how TV stations can be relocated in frequency space. Then the reallocation is stage three, that the FCC, having made some spectrum available, will allocate that spectrum to flexible use licenses. Stage four is the forward auction, to assign those flexible use licenses to the highest bidders. And then stage five is actual license assignments, where TV stations would presumably move or exit and or share, and new use could be made by these flexible use licenses. presumably for mobile communications, but perhaps for other things as well. So that's a lot to think about. We do have a paper that hit on the basic choices here. And I just want to say, in deference to my beautiful slides, that I do have a beautiful picture of Dr. Evil as a broadcaster, holding up the world for $1 gazillion. And I want to make it explicit that that is absolutely not the way to think about these auctions. Okay, that is not the way. Unfortunately, there's been a lot of that around. And I just want to make it clear that I consider it the audacity of chutzpah for regulators to blame the broadcasters for operating under the rules the regulators put in place. And that's exactly the tone of some of what has historically gone on. I think it's filtered out pretty well. I hope it has. But the point is, this is not about beating the broadcasters up. It's about creating very cooperative games here where there can be positive-sum transactions and stakeholders who are part of this process can become positive cooperators and inputs. So that really is the goal now. We need a lot of cooperation. It's a complicated process. That's a great slide, isn't it?
That is. I can attest. He has wonderful slides.
Thank you.
You would have really loved that.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Peter, you manage global spectrum issues for Intel. What are your thoughts on reverse auctions and particularly the mix that we need in terms of licensed versus unlicensed uses?
Okay. High and low. First off, we love incentive auctions. Intel and high-tech, much of the high-tech industry actually formed a coalition to help support this legislation, and we're very pleased with the result. We're not an altruistic company. We favored this because we wanted to see broadband, mobile broadband, become more widespread, higher quality, and more affordable. And we know there's a huge demand coming. And furthermore, technology is only going to increase the opportunities to benefit. And as Tom alluded to, getting spectrum in the marketplace is not easy. It's not easy in any country. I spend 80% of my time worrying about spectrum reallocation in other countries besides the United States. But having been around the track many times on this, it takes a very long time to try to take things back from people who have it. They're using it legitimately. It's a free country. They can hire lawyers and lobbyists, and the rest is delay. So instead of that, it's much better to create something that looks like a win-win-win opportunity. And the incentive auctions do that. That's the fundamental logic. No trade is going to take place unless it occurs voluntarily and implicitly the parties to the transaction, that is the participant in the reverse auction, the broadcaster, and then ultimately the participant in the forward auction who's prepared to pay more, are acting as if that transaction is going to be efficient. It's going to move from a lower to a higher value use. So that's just absolutely crucial. It makes it voluntary. It solves this huge political problem. But the other thing that's important about it is that it's going to free up that spectrum in the low-cost way because, as Tom said, when the broadcasters put in their bids for relocation or sharing or moving to a VHF or whatever it is, they're going to be indicating, hopefully if it's designed well, Tom, what the value of their business plan is, and then the commission can turn around and pick the low cost, that is the low cost to society, the low cost to the broadcaster, options, and therefore minimize the cost of freeing up 60, 80, up to 120 megahertz. The other thing that's going to happen, if it's properly structured and it's competitive, and I think it hopefully will be, but it should be, there will be a residual over for the taxpayers, and let's face it, the political reality is auction legislation always gets passed because of the political impetus coming from the budget process. So that, in a real-world sense, is what helped drive this through. I'm a realist. You know, I wish we didn't have to dig deep holes for oil, but we do. And I wish we didn't have to work the political process the way we do, but we do. And then the reality is that incentive auctions are able to tap into that, the gains from trade, and push the process forward. And the last thing, and far and away the most important thing about incentive auctions, is that there's every reason to believe that the benefit to society, that is consumers, the gains that they're going to get beyond what the costs are to them, are going to dwarf all these private costs that we were talking about, and maybe on the order of 10 times. In fact, Dr. Hazlett has done research in this area suggesting that, in fact, the consumer surplus gains will be on the order of 10 times the auction revenues. So that's a why we're in favor of incentive auctions. Now, Daryl, in deference to my other panelists, I think I'll come back to the unlicensed issue in a second round.
Okay.
That seems fair.
Yeah,
okay.
No, that's fine. So, Mark, you follow the radio and television broadcasting industries very carefully, and certainly one crucial ingredient in all this is how broadcasters respond. So what is your sense in terms of their interest in the auctions and likely participation?
Thank you, Daryl. I think there will be a number of television broadcasters who play this game who will volunteer either to share or actually give up all 6 megahertz. The prevailing prices of wireless spectrum now and in the future, and when we talk about the TV auction, we've got to remember that we're not talking about next year. We're talking about a few years down the road. If you look on the price per pop per megahertz, which is the general metric, it's a lot higher than some of the values of these stations that are actually operating. If you value their station on a price per pop per megahertz. So I think a lot of television stations, commercial and non-commercial television stations, will see an opportunity here to either share with another station or actually go out of business, give up all of the 6 megahertz, and to cede that part of the spectrum. There's a number of them. I will say that I don't think that there's enough to free up 120 megahertz. I think there's a lot of stations in these markets that are utilizing their spectrum. Then you can pick them out and you know which ones they are. They're multicasting. They're getting involved in mobile DTV and other opportunities. But I think there are a number of them. I will say, though, that there is a cost involved in that. And I remember Dr. Hazlett's 10 times the value in terms of consumer surplus paper. There is a cost in the reduction of diversity of some of the broadcasting options that may cede some of their spectrum, because in a sense these typically lower revenue stations, lower profitable stations tend to be ones that may be in multi-language and other types of diverse programming. That's not all of them, but there are some that provide those programming. So it isn't just a clear, as you mentioned, Peter, win-win-win. There is some sort of reduction in consumer surplus, but if we believe what Tom did a few years ago, that would dwarf it. So I think there is the opportunity there. We already are seeing a lot of investments in television stations, a lot of purchases of stations that are clearly spectrum plays. There are stations that were sold in the last 6 to 9 months that had been sold 2 or 3 years earlier, and the price that they were paid for in the last 6 to 9 months was substantially higher than what was sold 2 or 3 years earlier. And you can see that investors are already involved in some of these transactions in anticipation of these spectrum auctions coming through. So I'm somewhat optimistic about the activity of broadcasters who voluntarily will participate in these spectrum auctions.
Okay. Chris, what are your thoughts on reverse auction?
Sure. Daryl, thank you. It's rare that I get on a spectrum panel where I can say, after being the fourth speaker, that I actually agree with everyone before me. I think this is the first time I've had panel in the last 2 years. It's also rare that I get the last word since I have a wife and two daughters. It's actually rare that I get any words in. You know, we at CTI, we represent the carriers, the manufacturers, the vendors, content providers, sort of all of the above. And we're the organization that coined the term looming spectrum crisis because we looked at what was happening in the mobile market in terms of demand and usage and the evolution of the networks and the products and the services and saw the trend line was like a hockey stick. I mean, it had been slowly going up and then data took off and it almost went vertical. And then we looked at the spectrum that was in the pipeline and thought, wow, this is not an equation that makes sense for continued innovation and investment and growth. And so then we thought, well, gosh, we're in Washington. How do we get people's attention? And we stepped back and started to think as marketers do, and we branded it. We came up with this phrase, looming spectrum crisis, because it was looming, and from our perspective, it was a crisis because it didn't really have any focus. And what we did is then we kind of looked around the world and tried to get a sense of what other countries were doing. And as we looked at every country that we would want to compare ourselves to from a broadband perspective and additionally from a mobile broadband perspective, every single country that we were looking at had hundreds of megahertz in the pipeline or were about to put hundreds of megahertz in the pipeline. So South Korea, UK, Canada, France, Italy, Germany, Japan, you know, they all had identified a great deal of spectrum to reallocate. And if you look at, and this is I was an economist by trade before I went to law school, so this is a little bit of rough justice. But if you look at the population of those countries, the closest is Japan that has about a third of our population. And yet they were bringing hundreds of megahertz to market, and we had about 25 megahertz in the pipeline. So when the national broadband team came up with this idea of an incentive auction, of a reverse auction, we thought it was fantastic because we began to look at ways to repurpose spectrum, and we were excited about market mechanisms that would take what otherwise wasn't subjected to a market environment and you know, facilitate that. So we were excited about the idea of taking applying this sort of a mechanism to the broadcasters and allowing them the opportunity, if they chose, to monetize an asset that they otherwise might not have an opportunity to monetize. We particularly liked it being applied to the broadcasters because we looked at the 294 megahertz of spectrum. I think Tom mentioned that earlier. If you look at D.C., D.C. has 19 high-power operational stations. I would challenge anyone to go past and name more than 7 in the D.C. market, but there are 19. And that's 114 megahertz of spectrum being used. There's 294 allocated. So there's 180 megahertz in D.C. that isn't being used. It's actually being used as a buffer because of operations in whether it's Richmond or Baltimore. And so we were trying to figure out, well, how do you squeeze out that excess spectrum? How do you drive a little bit more efficiency? And sure enough, this incentive auction idea will allow the FCC to pay some broadcasters to exit or channel share, and then they apply some very intelligent algorithms. They get some smart people to think, boy, if we can pull out, you know, a half dozen here and four here and six there, we can repack these. The other way of driving in addition to clearing, which the incentive auction will help do, is sharing. And you heard Tom Power talk a little bit about that. And sort of simultaneous with the effort to clear bands of spectrum, we're also looking at how you can share in a geographic sense or a temporal sense, or you know, having two compatible uses at the same time. And for us, that sort of all of the above needs to be investigated because we're seeing all of the predictions that we saw about data demand were premised on sort of underlying data, which is already being outpaced. The actual data usage is exceeding what was the underlying principles of the analysis that was done for the predictions that said we would have 13, 15, 20 times increase in data usage over the next 5 years. And so for us, it's, I think, Tom, what did you say? Expeditious and efficient.
Yeah.
we like to think sort of in the John Wooden sense.
Check the slide.
Be quick, but don't hurry. So that's where we are. We think all of the above. It's going to need technical solutions that will come from companies like Peter's at Intel and Qualcomm and others, small cells, femtocells, picocells, but it also take the repurposing of a great deal of spectrum to keep us sort of where we are. We're in a position of envy right now around the world. We have the hottest selling handsets launched here first. We have about 70% of the world's LTE subscribers, even though we only have 6% of the world's mobile population. We have the epicenter of the apps world, obviously. And so it's a sort of a perfect storm, which is positive. We want it to stay that way.
Thank you. Thomas, in your paper, you throw out a number of very interesting ideas, such as not having a maximum reserve price in the auctions, making announcements in terms of future auctions, setting timetables for the release of flexible use licenses. Could you talk a little bit about some of your particular recommendations on how you think the auction should operate?
Sure. And I thank you very much for these interesting comments. I've been paying attention and learning something here.
No new slides, though, huh?
Always be quick, never hurry. That's the John Wooden quote, I think.
Yeah.
Wonderful. I should have used that one in my PowerPoint slide. So the no reserve prices. So let's talk about the reserve auction. I don't think we like the reserve prices in either auction, but in the reserve auction, there seems to be some kind of an issue about this that's already burgeoning. I want to say that, of course, we're all, in essence, speculating about what the structure is. We haven't gotten much guidance from the regulators yet. It's not a critical comment. Always be quick, never hurry. It's been 4 months since the legislation, so something will come out in due time, but we hope it's not too much time. Anyway, what we talk about here is all just high-level thinking, because we don't have something to react to at this point. So reserve prices, we want the stations to state their prices. We don't want to give them a limit at which point we cut them off. We want to see what all the actual demands are in terms of what they'll take for a payment. Now, of course, the FCC is going to take that information, and the way I read the legislation, they're going to have to make sure that everything pencils out at the end of the day, that there actually is going to be money coming in the forward auction to pay. So that's all the reserve, or that's all the backstop you need on the demands of the broadcasters. There certainly could be a situation where the broadcasters are asking very high prices to move, and there will be very little spectrum reallocated, as we'll find out in matching those bids. So there's no reason to truncate that process with reserve prices. By the way, on the other side of that, the forward licenses, this is more controversial, I think. I don't think the forward licenses should have reserve prices either, and I've written a lot about this. The reserve price means that the government wants to bid on the spectrum, and if a certain price doesn't come in, they're going to keep it, and they're going to have a spectrum warehouse where the spectrum will do nothing. And the government thinks it's a better owner or shepherd than the market, with those rights out there in the marketplace. The prices may go low at some point, and they may get higher at other points. They may be traded around in ways that don't look like they're stimulating a lot of value, but that's actually a big advance. So we actually, if somebody's interested, I'll send you the paper. We've actually estimated in some places, some countries, they've actually withheld spectrum from the market because certain bids did not hit the reserve prices, and they've cost their consumers millions and millions of dollars in consumer surplus because they put less spectrum out in the market that withholds capacity and raises prices, restricts the amount of competition there can be. So reserve prices are problematic. Timetables, yes. When people bid on a resource, they want to know when they get the resource. And if the regulator is going to hold the resources back for some number of years, that's a problem. It creates uncertainty. It makes bidding problematic. And it leads to kind of quagmire kinds of political disputes down the road. So you want to set some timetables and stick to them. Now, timetables themselves are not all that easy because sometimes people can be in a situation where if they don't hit a timetable, then certain things are triggered, and now all of a sudden you're back to square one. So you got to be careful even on the timetable. But the idea is to get a path here that does tell the bidders when they're going to get the resources. And if they don't get the resources, then there's some recourse for the bidders. Did you ask about the releasing the plans ahead of time?
Yes.
Yeah. So another thing we recommend is that when the TV stations are going to make their offers, bidding in the reverse auction, that they have some idea, hopefully a good idea, of what the FCC has in store for the repacking. And so that means that the FCC should be transparent about that, put that on the table, and make bidding a lot easier. And presumably the price is lower for the exit or the sharing. I don't know if this has come up. I don't think I caught it. If it did, channel sharing, by stations will, if this is done right, almost certainly be a very important way of clearing spectrum. Okay, because it seems to be a fairly low cost way for stations to continue doing what they're doing now, and yet put spectrum for a price in the marketplace. Something I missed?
No, I think that pretty well covers it.
Can I just make one comment?
Sure.
And just your last comment, Tom, about the sharing. I agree wholeheartedly that it's a great aspect of the reverse auction and planning. But I think it's more than just a low cost. I mean, it's going to be very complicated insofar about which stations can share with each other in terms of still being able to serve their community of licenses, and to say nothing about relocating antennas and towers and all the technical. I mean, it is engineering, but it isn't. I don't think we should minimize the steps that need to be taken, even when stations are shared. But I mean, it can be done, but it's not an easy problem to be overcome.
May I add one thing?
Peter, if you want to jump in.
Yes, just briefly. First, I want to incorporate by reference all of Tom's remarks. I think he's spot on in terms of the direction. Now, we don't know what the FCC is going to do, and I reserve the right to get smarter on this stuff. But one thing I have learned as I go around the world trying to get spectrum in the marketplace, government warehousing spectrum is a huge problem. And frankly, some of the biggest proponents of government's warehousing spectrum are incumbents. And so if they aren't ready, if they have embedded revenues that they're concerned about, if they fear a new competitor, if they fear a new technology and don't want to update their technology, they're all too willing to go to the government and say, you really shouldn't move now. And it would be country after country would be better off if they got the spectrum in the marketplace, someone would buy it, face the opportunity cost of sitting on it and not moving to a new technology. And so I think it's really important to keep that front and center.
And Peter, could you also address the issue of license versus
unlicensed? Oh, right, yeah. That, I think that's a very interesting issue and maybe helps thinking about spectrum in general. One of the issues is, well, okay, once we free up this spectrum through the reverse auction, what do we do with it? And as you heard from all of us, I think, even Mark, that the value to society from licensed, high-powered 3G, 4G type services is likely to be enormous. And so the question is, should any of this spectrum be unlicensed? And in the legislative discussions and policy discussions, and I'm sure this will be a big, important part of the SEC discussions, there'll be a question about, well, should any of this be used and unlicensed? And one of the ideas that people kick around is, well, maybe we can use the duplex gap. I guess the FCC goes in and says, we decide it should be paired spectrum, and there will be a duplex gap. And some have argued, well, this is a low opportunity cost way of creating unlicensed. And I want to just put out there that we need to be thinking about this very rigorously, because I would submit there's a lot of evidence to believe that any duplex gap, if in fact one exists, doesn't have to be relegated to a low-powered use. All you need to do is look at what AT&T bought Qualcomm's media flow spectrum for roughly $2 billion, a dollar a megahertz pop, and they're going to pair it. This is UHF spectrum. They're going to pair it with their spectrum at higher bands because, in fact, there would be a problem using it down in the UHF band. But they could use it at 800, 1.9, wherever. And given the new releases for LTE, the long-term evolution spectrum that we've been referring to, this is entirely possible. And that's why AT&T was prepared to pay $1 a megahertz pop for the spectrum. So as the FCC goes forward, I hope that we have a rigorous discussion of what the most valuable uses for this spectrum will be. And in that context, I strongly suspect that none of this will go to unlicensed.
So, Chris, if you're let's put you in the role of advising the FCC. So what advice would you give them in terms of some of the things we've been talking about?
Be quick, but don't hurry.
I've heard that before.
No, I mean, this is so, and I know they're doing this, but take this enormously complex effort and break it into bite-sized pieces. So there are elements of the forward auction that they need to focus on, and I would say with regard to the forward auction, the auction to the ultimate new licensees, new holders of this spectrum, I would say make sure you don't replicate some of your mistakes of the past. The recent 700 megahertz auction was just it was poorly designed in the sense that there were no licenses that were fungible. It was difficult for an entity to come in and say, I'll bid on, you know, the A block or the B or the C or the D. One had a public safety obligation. One had an open access obligation. So just make sure that you don't try to sort of tailor make the auction for certain business plans, the forward part of it. The reverse part of it is get out as much information. I think we're all sort of talking off the same song sheet, but get as much information as you can to the broadcasters as soon as possible, because the likely participants in a reverse auction from the broadcast community are not always going to be those with the most personnel and financial resources. So you're going to need to really do a good job educating them as to why they may want to participate, why they may want to monetize an asset, that this may be their sole opportunity to monetize it in this environment. And then make sure you make the process that the complexity isn't such that it overwhelms parties on either side of the equation. I know some economists may think, and ultimately the commission may decide, that a simultaneous reverse and forward auction may make the most sense. I could see someone's head exploding as they're trying to bid on something that they don't know whether or not it exists, and how do you value that? And so trying to make the process one that is understandable for both sets of participants, because for there are sort of a multitude of reasons, but this is the entirety of the regulatory and policy world is watching the United States to see if this actually works. And it's important that it works, not only because it can be applied to other potential bands of spectrum, but it's important that it works because we're running out of cleared bands of spectrum, sort of greenfield bands of spectrum that can be auctioned. So we've got to think of ways of bringing spectrum to market. And a couple people danced around this a little bit, but one thing I missed is that in addition to clearing spectrum, and sharing spectrum, you really need to have a robust secondary market. There needs to be an understanding at the FCC that to the extent that parties can move spectrum assets from A to B, it really needs to be facilitated. It doesn't mean there shouldn't be rigorous reviews, antitrust reviews, and things like that. But what I'm saying is there needs to be a mechanism by which spectrum that whether it's after this incentive auction or after the auction of some of the government spectrum, but that it can be put to use. The reason why the government's getting involved in the broadcast spectrum is because it doesn't do a lot of good to clear one 6 megahertz channel in New York and then to clear a different 6 megahertz channel in Chicago and a different one in L.A. You know, the FCC is acting as the entity that will sort of repackage and then repurpose this spectrum. But there are a lot of opportunities where you don't need a government entity to get involved. The secondary market transaction will do just fine. And we continue to say all of the above. Technology, then repurposing a spectrum is what's going to allow us to sort of continue to innovate and invest.
Okay, so Tom had a comment on combination bidding. Then we're going to open the floor to questions from the audience.
Yeah, thanks, Daryl. I should have mentioned this before, and that is the one thing that does come up, and it follows on this idea that it should be expeditious and efficient and not too complicated and so forth. It's time for combination bidding. Okay, now, in the year 2000, the FCC had a very nice big conference on this out at Y River and talked about how they're going to do combination bidding, and they, to this day, they have not really done it. There's been a little bit sprinkled in places where it didn't make a lot of difference. Combination or package bidding, as it's sometimes called, makes the bidding process for the bidders a lot easier. The irony is it can make figuring out who wins for the regulatory agency, the auctioneer, more difficult. And the FCC has shied away because they don't, for obvious reasons, they don't want too much information burden on the agency, and they're afraid of that. But it's time to cross that threshold and get serious about the bids. On the reverse auction, you almost have to have combination bids because of these, I think Mark was talking about all these stations that cross over various markets. So putting in a bid just to clear out of Washington, D.C. or Richmond or whatever doesn't make a lot of sense. You can do it that way, but it's a much more economic and efficient process to have combination bidding. So we certainly pitch that strongly. The economists are all, I think, of that opinion, but it's not a situation where the economists, unusual as it may sound, it's not where the economists are out in outer space saying this really, this really tracks well on our formal model. It's also in the real world. With real bidders, a big convenience to be able to put in a package bid.
You should explain a little bit what combination.
Yeah. Well, you if you have multiple TV stations, you can put a bid in that you're offering a certain price for all of the TV stations to exit or share, or you can put a bid in that you're going to exit from, say, two or three different markets because that's where your crossovers are, and so it's not just exiting one market. So that it's not just a market-by-market, station-by-station bid. So it's a combination or a package. And the FCC will have to define that. Again, there's lots of places to screw that up. So you don't want to just say do whatever you want. You have to be careful through all of these things. But it is time to go to combinatorial bidding.
A quick comment, then we're going to move to the
sure.
audience.
I want you to talk about the combinational bidding and with related to the television station. I read it in your paper, and I agree it would be nice to have that flexibility, but I don't think that's so necessary for groups of television stations insofar as that they do believe, they look at themselves as broadcasted in individual markets, and if they determine that they want to sell their station or share their station in Boston, that might not affect how they operate in Richmond. I mean, they are distinct markets. So I think it would be a nice little flexibility, but I would I think it would just add a lot of complexity. But
okay, let's move to the audience. We have people with microphones. We have a question in the very back, so if we can get the microphone over there. If you can give us your name and organization, please.
Yeah. Jim Snyder from iSolon and Harvard University's Edmund J. Safra Center for Ethics. So the subtext of the panel is that Washington, D.C. is so corrupt that the only way to get this spectrum used efficiently is to give tens of billions of dollars of rights to the broadcasters. Now, I imagine in 10 years from now, if a historian comes and asks members of this panel, at least several of them will acknowledge, yeah, this was all make-believe. I was at a panel at Brookings, and we engaged in this make-believe of win, win, win. I really knew that this was a huge giveaway, but it wasn't in my interest, maybe even the interest of the public, to acknowledge it, so we sort of pretended the issue didn't exist. But
so, Jim, is there a question in there?
Yeah, really.
Yes, there is. So the question is equity. I'm asking you, many of you are known for making some heroic assumptions and predictions. Your prediction for what percentage of the windfall from rezoning the broadcaster spectrum, giving them flexibility, a huge increase in the value of the spectrum, what percentage of that windfall will go to the public versus the broadcast when the dust is settled and the auction? I know we don't have a lot of details, but again, there's a lot of heroic assumptions and predictions that have been made. Why not have one on the equity argument. I know some people like Tom denied the validity of the assumptions behind my question, and because I loved his statement that there's no such phenomenon as regulatory capture. You didn't use those words, but the broadcasters were merely a victim of the FCC rather than the FCC being a creature of broadcast lobbying over the decades. Anyway,
okay,
that's an aside. So my question is very precise.
Yep.
Just for the record,
let me point out, I did not use those words.
Yeah.
But I said it much differently than that.
But
there is no windfall here. Okay, the windfall is already out there.
Yeah.
And it's been out there for some decades. And the shareholders that were the beneficiaries of that windfall, God rest their souls. Now we have a situation where we have a market that looks like this. And if you have a better way to do this, okay, you know, put it in the record. I do have a better way to do it. And I put it in the record. And they went this way. But if you really want to attack the windfall, put a bill into Congress saying we're going to tax the broadcasters after this all is said and done. We're going to take away all their money. And that would be the way to do it. Do it separately and see how that flies. But if you want to do something for society and for consumers, you'll go with some process that's going to reallocate with the cooperation of the broadcasters.
And I would just add, first off, it's important for the people in the audience to realize that the vast majority of commercial broadcasters are not the initial licensees. They went in the marketplace, they bought their license, they paid a market clearing price for that property. It reflected the imputed value of the spectrum. Okay, so that's for starters. Okay, the second thing is that, as Tom and many other auction experts have discussed, indeed in our pleadings on this, or documents on the Hill, we pointed out this can be structured in a competitive way. So if, just very briefly, if in fact the market is structured, the auction is structured properly, and there are multiple broadcasters, they may get something close to the broadcasting value of this property. Because if there are, let's say, 10 stations, and the commission says, I see a puzzled face here, so I'm going to try to dive deep on this because I think it's a really important point. If there are 10 stations at a given market, and the commission may need 3 or 4 or 5 to clear, and they say, okay, everyone give us a bid that you would take, knowing that everyone's going to get the price to the cleared station, the last cleared station. So they get 10 bids, for example, and they get ranked from 1 to 10, and the commission says, okay, for... We can buy out these 4 stations. All 4 of them are going to get that price paid to the 4th station. If that process is competitive, because if I know that if I get too greedy as a broadcaster, I may not be one of the 4. That means that they're all going to get something related to the broadcaster, the 4th broadcasters. And the beauty of this is you pick the least valuable broadcasters, and the value to taxpayers could be in the tens of billions of dollars. And you don't have to take my word for it. CBO, who tends to be pretty rigorous about this and has always underestimated the auction revenues generated, has estimated that $24 billion will come to the taxpayers.
In your preamble before your question, you somewhat disparaged all of us, but let me just speak for myself, okay?
Thank you.
Well, no, I just want to say that, and I'm going to echo what Tom said. I mean, we're dealing in reality in 2012, whether it's a looming spectrum crisis. I hope you trademarked that phrase.
We did.
Okay, good.
No, I don't think
we did. I mean, there is a demand, and there is this way of getting some spectrum back to other alternative uses. That's the reality of it. And the reality is that there will be some broadcasters who will bid to give back their spectrum, whether it's a windfall, as you suggested, or just an appropriate compensation. That's the reality, and that's what we're going to do with. Outside of that, as Tom suggested, come up with another plan that somehow appropriately and fairly gets that spectrum as quick as you can. He wants to respond to your comments.
Yeah, well, I'm going to speak loud so my friends at NAB down the block can actually hear me.
Well, there's
defend
some
people.
Them. There's
oh,
some
yeah, yeah, okay, there we go. Yeah.
Well, I see some over there.
listen, so let's take your premise at its face. So where's the windfall, right? You're asking stations that have actually invested money, built out, and are operating,
to exit the market. How would they exit the market? They would sell to someone else. We're asking them to sell to us, and the intermediary is the FCC. In terms of windfall, I would say, and Peter talked a little bit about the CBO scoring, I'll throw out mHealth and intelligent transportation and smart grids. And, you know, I'm wearing an mHealth device on my hip at this moment. My house has been transferred to a smart grid house. My children in public school in Arlington using mobile education. They have four or five different types of mobile devices in their school. So facilitating that is a windfall for the United States. So the calculation doesn't begin and end with the transaction at the auction, right? It's what happens after that and the tens, if not hundreds of billions, that will immediately flow from that. And so what goes to the broadcasters as part of that transaction is a pittance compared to what goes to the American and American economy as a result of that transaction, whether it's directly to the Treasury or beyond.
I have an actual correction,
if I could. Sure, quickly.
CBO estimate. I've seen that in congressional hearings.
Can you give them the microphone, please?
Yes. He gave the figure of $24 billion. There's two problems with that. One, I talked to the CBO person who gave the estimate. If you want, she very clearly said that was a composite number that include the auctioning of government spectrum and broadcast spectrum, and she refused to give the component from the broadcast component, and she would not deny that there wasn't essentially a zero net gain. So you can't use this, apples and oranges.
Jim, it's just absolutely preposterous. The broadcast, I know Kathy well. Our coalition hired Coleman Bazelon, who is one of the leading experts on the auction issue, came up with comparable numbers and conservative numbers. And the government spectrum, if you're talking about white spaces spectrum, is, let's face it, it's the Swiss cheese. The broadcasters sensibly are located in the holes where all the people are. So the likelihood that a significant portion of that $24 billion would go for spectrum where there's plenty of spectrum already is de minimis.
And the $24 billion figure is wrong.
Okay, we have some other people have questions. Over there in the back. Yep.
How you doing? Seton Motley with Less Government. You mentioned – thank you. You mentioned,
I'm for it.
Thank you. You mentioned the secondary market.
Occupy Spectrum.
Yes. I'd refer you to the slide. You mentioned the secondary market being not nearly as vigorous as it should be.
Sure.
I would argue, or I'm asking, isn't the hyper-regulatory nature of this particular FCC especially, where they're slapping illegal conditions on every merger, every deal, you've got the April 2011 order on the data roaming, you've got, and this doesn't happen in a vacuum. They see net neutrality, they see data roaming, they see all of these illegal conditions placed on, all these conditions placed on these mergers without a rulemaking process, without legislation from Congress. Doesn't that make people who may want to go into a secondary market and sell spectrum a lot more reluctant and not even try to enter the field because they're going to get hammered by the FCC with all these conditions and regulations?
Sure. First part, conditions have been parts of transactions forever, and I think most people would, you know, depending upon which side of the equation you're on, would say they make absolutely no sense or they make complete and total sense. I tend to fall on the side of, you know, if it's something that's extremely important that isn't company specific, it should be done as part of a rulemaking. That's what Congress sort of envisioned with the APA. Your broader question, take it up to the macro level, secondary market transactions are absolutely inevitable going forward. And so they need to be facilitated, and they should have a robust and rigorous review. We have antitrust rules in place for a purpose, but they also, the transaction itself and the idea of moving an asset that is an asset of the people from a less efficient use to a more efficient use is something that should be fully and completely embraced. I wouldn't say that there's, you know, any significant impediments to it now. It just should be looked at and reviewed maybe not in the context of an existing transaction, but more holistically as to how do we make sure that we get these assets. And people are starting to look at it. The white spaces is an example where there's, the commission is looking at, and independent parties are now looking at creating databases to take advantage of areas that are unoccupied. We're looking at it in the context of sharing, and can you have a temporal or geographic sharing or the sharing of compatible uses. But I guess our point is all of the above is going to be absolutely necessary going forward. And you heard me say it a number of times, and people in Congress are getting tired of me saying it in testimony, but everything has to be considered because, Canada, just saw an article in Canada saying there's no looming spectrum crisis in Canada because they're about to have 540 megahertz in the market. They've got 30 million citizens. We've got 330. So we don't have 540 megahertz in our market. If you do a simple arithmetic equation, sure, if we had, 4,000 megahertz in our market, there wouldn't be a looming spectrum crisis in the United States either. So I would say all of the above. Less government is generally good. So I applaud the entity as a whole. But there are times where it's needed, and this reverse auction is one thing.
Let's get a couple more questions, just because we're running out of time. Sure. Other questions that people have?
Can I just add something to it? It's unfortunate that the trademark won't be profitable in Canada. The other thing that I think is important in part of the forward auction, and I've heard some talk about this, I know we're emphasizing reverse auction, is limiting the types of companies that would participate in the forward auction. I think you may get an agreement among all of us here that that's just the wrong idea, that you need to have everybody in to get it to the most efficient and best use.
Other questions? For a panel, what is your sense of the timetable on this? I know auctions take years to design and implement. What are we talking about here?
You're closest to it.
Not it. after the summer, beginning of the process at the FCC in terms of an NPRM, probably.
2022?
Statutorily, some of the auctions for the government spectrum are going to happen in the first quarter of 2015, or not auctions. The licenses have to be assigned and finalized by the first quarter of 2015. If the commission wants to honor its goal of getting 300 megahertz into the market by March of 2015, they're going to have to move somewhat quickly. And that means launching this proceeding late summer, early fall, at the latest. And that means launching it. And so then we've got, a significant process.
By statute, they have to have 300 megahertz?
No, that's what I'm saying. So there are two things that are sort of helping to put some pressure on. One is by statute, there has to be an auction of about 70 megahertz of spectrum, and the assignment of the licenses by March of 2015. By their own goals in the National Broadband Plan, they were going to have 300 megahertz by February of 2015. So in order to get there, you need more than the 70 megahertz that's been identified in the legislation. You need the spectrum that's been identified and as part of the broadcast reallocation.
I would say this. There are few things that the FCC is doing that have the potential to generate as much for society as this, and if they can get it done sooner by adding more people, they ought to do it. And they ought to be taking them away from other areas, probably, if they need to do it. The delay here could be enormous. And just to put this in perspective, as some of us have noted, this spectrum is a non-depletable resource. It's like the wind. If you put up a windmill 3 years from now, it's not like you can capture any of the value of the wind from the prior 3 years, right? That's exactly what we're talking about here. And there's a net gain to society from this occurring. And if the loss to society is like 5% per year, then you've lost probably 14% of the net present value of the spectrum. So delay is enormously costly here. Yes, let's get it right, but I put emphasis on moving quickly.
Yeah, I would also, with the discussion we had a little bit ago on the estimates of the actual net revenues for the U.S. government, to be honest, I didn't listen to most of that because it's totally uninteresting to me. the numbers are on the side of consumer surplus, and they are at least an order of magnitude above whatever the take is. I mean, look at today's market. There's at least $200 billion in consumer surplus in mobile services. I mean, in the most conservative way, you can actually measure it. And it is constrained. You get more service at lower cost, more business models, more competition, even with the same number of actual networks. You got lower marginal costs for the existing networks. You get more of everything for consumers when you get more spectrum in that market, and the consumer gains are extremely large. And when we talk about taking TV stations off the air, we're not talking, with all due respect, Peter, I think, said the low-valued stations. It's not the low-valued stations. We're not taking stations out. The stations can stay. Their programming can stay. Okay? We're taking the broadcast facilities out. And there's a huge difference. Okay, there's a massive shift that's already taken place in this country that much more than 90% of TV viewing is on cable and satellite. And the next generation is already here. It's broadband. And so we have something that has a very low value to society, which is terrestrial broadcast, where stations on a digital multiplex have six program feeds that they're putting out there. And in essence, the only one people watch is the one that goes on cable and satellite, the primary feed. And we're reorganizing that. We're losing almost nothing. Okay. Now, I say that having had an unbelievably upsetting incident last night with 4 minutes and 10 seconds left in the NBA playoff championship series. Did I say NBA playoff championship series? Did you get this? On DirecTV, they cut off all local television. I'm surprised I'm here today. I was apoplectic.
You should have had an outdoor antenna. You could have picked up the station right away, and you wouldn't have had a problem.
Not where I live in Maryland. Right. So that's not even a solution.
Okay, we have one more question. Actually, can you hold on until you get to the microphone so we can hear you?
Dennis Wharton with NAB. Okay. Dennis Wharton. Mark had a good solution, put up an antenna. And your comment that less than 10%
for 4 minutes a year,
less than 10% of Americans are over the air. That's actually 17%. 56 million people.
No.
There are new studies that will be coming out very soon that will demonstrate that. So my question to you though is, if cell phone companies had every broadcast station out of business in a time of crisis, in a hurricane, in an earthquake, would you be able to communicate? Because we know that from history has shown that the cell phone networks crash. If you had every piece of spectrum that broadcasters had, if you ever had every piece of spectrum that the Defense Department had, would you be able to communicate in a time of crisis?
So I was going to make a joke about these are the new tornado warnings, the NBA playoffs, and you don't want to be without the playoffs because you need over the air, and you've made it. You've gotten to my punchline before I could. No, that's not the efficient way to have warnings. And, in fact, where I live, we don't have good over-the-air broadcasting. It's in major parts of the country. So in the 17%, look, you can jack these numbers up. It's just not. Look, in our house we have five televisions. One of them just sits there. It's counted as an over-the-air receiver. I understand how you can jack those numbers up. Of course we don't watch the one that doesn't have satellite and cable programming. I mean, that's the way it goes. 91% of households have cable and satellite, and that's what they tend to watch. And the people who don't have it tend not to watch television. A lot of my students don't have cable or satellite. They don't watch television. They're law students. At least they want to admit to watching television.
They're working so hard for your class, right?
It must be something else.
But the part of his question in turn.
Yes, but I think what another response, I'll be more moderate atypically here today. The another response is the vast majority of stations, though Tom's point is very telling, are still going to be available over the air after this process. After the dust settles, the smog a day clears, the vast majority of over-the-air broadcasters are still going to be in business, either because they're sharing or they haven't sold out at all.
And let's be honest, you know, the idea of we should not pursue this, I don't know if this is what you're suggesting, Dennis, but it seems that way, that we should not pursue this because we want to continue to make sure that we can send alerts over over-the-air television seems, I don't know, a little strange or misplaced when the idea of the federal government and the WARN Act and others is to send alerts over a multitude of transmission vehicles just in case you're not in front of your over-the-air broadcast television, which
or in front of
whatever in front of, whatever percentage that is, 9 or 17 or 42. We just launched, Wireless just launched a voluntary program. Prior to us launching that, I was crossing over the GW Bridge, and there was a microblast in Arlington that was moving right down Glebe Road. And I didn't hear about this microblast from my broadcast television because I was in my car. I also didn't hear about it from my FM radio in spite of the fact that I had Mix 107.3 on. I heard about it, and my wife did simultaneously, from our mobile devices, which we both had on ourselves. And we got an interesting cadence from a voluntary service from Arlington Alert, and that's what told us what was about to hit us. And we pulled over, and trees dropped, telephone poles were severed in half. I mean, it looked like a war zone. And the only way we heard about it was from our mobile phone. I'm glad we had it. I'm also glad that if we had been at home, it would have told us, get in your basement on the television or on the radio. It's all of the above. So the notion that we insert the fact that broadcasters give us information about it, that's fantastic. But I don't think it's part of this discussion or this equation, in spite of the fact that Dennis talks about it, in spite of the fact that I've testified in front of Congress a half dozen times over the last 6 years about it. This has nothing to do with reverse auctions. They're voluntary. The broadcasters that want to participate will participate. Those that don't are going to be protected in some form. So I think it's a little misplaced at 5 minutes before the end of the program to have a discussion about maintaining over-the-air broadcast television so that all broadcasters, so that we can get emergency alerts.
Okay, we have time for one more question right here in the front row, if you can get the microphone over here. And if you could give us your name and organization, please.
Hi, my name is John Custer. I'm with Mintz Levin and ML Strategies. I promise I'm not going to throw any rocks at you guys.
Like
I'm up here in the front.
Yeah, your shoes are great.
Yeah, I love
your
socks.
You guys don't see this.
I can't help myself. It's got to be a clown question, dude.
Bro. You mentioned that you're wearing a medical device that operates, you know, wireless technology. I cover a lot of healthcare stuff for Mintz. So my question is more focused on M-bands, which are medical area body networks and things like that. What do you think the future of spectrum allocation to those sort of things is going to be? Because it seems like, based on everything that I've watched with the FCC recently, that everyone wants to move in that direction, and everyone kind of agrees that there should be spectrum available for these sort of things, especially the more advanced monitoring systems that will be able to tell you your heart rate, things like that, from home, so doctors can stay on top of that without having you wired in the hospital.
Sure.
But it seems like everything is a super slow process here, and this seems like one of the things that really should move quickly, and I know the FCC is of the same opinion, but, you know, what's going to happen?
So this is the device. It monitors my heart rhythms, my heart rate. It is connected. It's branded to a certain carrier who has a couple people in this audience right now who I won't mention.
CTIA.
They're members of
CTIA. Okay, good.
This is an off-the-shelf device that has been loaded with a capability to manage, to monitor a number of leads. And this is done over commercial spectrum. A lot of times we get asked the question about should there be spectrum set aside for mobile health? Should there be spectrum set aside for smart grids? I would argue that in most cases there are a lot of companies in the United States that actually manage networks for a living and do a pretty good job of it, and this is a good example. If there are instances where there's a need to have, you know, for telemetry, for medical uses, to have dedicated spectrum, I can see people wanting that, but then you've got to build a network to actually manage that. And so I think more often than not, in order to get products to market, you're going to see them launch. We have them, we call them verticals. The verticals at our trade show have exploded compared to sort of the traditional carrier-consumer relationship. And almost all of those verticals operate on carrier networks because the networks are built, they exist, and the reality is these devices are a hell of a lot more sophisticated than, say, our public safety entities have on their built networks. And so the idea of sharing in the public safety space is moving to using commercial networks so that they can take advantage of scale, scope, economies that go with it. So I would say you'll probably see both of the above, standalone issue-specific networks, but I think you're going to see a lot more being launched over the commercial networks because of the, you just got to tinker with a little device like this, and all of a sudden you've got, a product that does just that. It lowers healthcare costs, and it allows me to be out here and not tied to a device which I have to then plug into a phone or bring back to the hospital.
Right. It's funny that you mentioned public safety things. I actually covered the Open Commission meeting yesterday where they talked about the lack of development with public safety with like the mesh-wide area networks and stuff like that, and they were going to open up Spectrum to secondary commercial use because of that.
Right, and you see a lot of that. Spectrum that was dedicated to a specific use that it doesn't work or it lies fallow, and then you've got to go in and reclaim it. Mobile satellite service is a perfect example. It was a great deal of spectrum was allocated for it. Very, very few companies got off the ground. Even those that managed to launch satellites weren't able to make a business model of it. And so we're reclaiming it either through an FCC process or Dish Network is trying a secondary market approach to try to repackage that spectrum. So.
Thank you.
Okay, I want to thank Thomas, Peter, Mark, and Chris for sharing your thoughts with us, and thank you very much for coming out.
Thank you. We didn't disagree on that.
Hey, I'm next.